Shalom Aleichem. It's great to be here. Thank you, Rabbi Orlian, for asking me to join you guys today. So as Rabbi Orlian mentioned, I think what we're going to try to focus on is issues that Rabbanim, since your future Rabbanim, Be'ezus Hashem, so we're going to try and focus on issues that Rabbanim need to know and issues that Rabbanim are asked about on a regular basis, and not all Rabbanim are fluent in these areas, so even if we can't necessarily give over everything al regalachas, but at least a potential benefit of being here is to at least hear some of the issues that do come up, and there's a tremendous amount to cover, and Be'etzem we could, the shir could be 5 or 6 hours long. But we'll try and compress it as much as possible. But please don't hesitate to interrupt, to ask questions, because the idea is to try and give as much clarity as possible. And obviously, often that will entail asking and answering questions. So since Purim was a couple of days ago, and I just found out 3 minutes ago that one of the Chashuva future Rabbanim here has a Megillah that was made by myself for him, unbeknownst to me. So when I was asked to create that Megillah, so I asked what type of Megillah they wanted, and the answer was, make it as you would make it for yourself, which is what I did. So we'll discuss just briefly some of the issues related to Hilchos Megillah, since we're less than 24, 48, 72 hours away from Purim, depending on where you live. I landed this morning. There were people on my flight who had come straight from their Adula Yada directly onto the airplane. It was a little bit interesting. Baruch Hashem. It's the beauty of Eretz Yisrael, is that even the stewards and stewardesses are dressed up in the airport, on the plane, and so forth. So one of the primary issues related to Hilchos Megillah, which again was mentioned just a couple of minutes ago, that one of the Rosh Yeshiva here is makbid about, and that's having an 11-line Megillah. There are many that are makbid on having an 11-line Megillah, and the question is really a twofold question. One is just to understand the background. Why would somebody want an 11-line Megillah? What's special about an 11-line Megillah? And question number two is whether one actually should have an 11-line Megillah. Is that actually what's preferred or not? Like most things in Yiddishkeit, there's no wrong answer. Generally, these things involve a difference of opinion amongst different paiskim, and this is no different. So we'll just try and explain briefly the background of an 11-line Megillah, what it's all about, and then we'll try and deal with the question of whether that's actually the preferred option or not. So the reason why there's such a thing as an 11-line Megillah, which at first blush seems a bit odd, we know that Sifrei Torah and Nevi'im have many more lines than that. So why would a Megillah Esther be any different than any other of the Svarim of Tanakh? So the answer is as follows. There is a Maseches Sofrim, which indicates that the Aseres B'nei Haman should be written on 11 lines. And according to some readings of that, ideally they should be written on their own amud, meaning on their own column. Now, if you have a regular sized sefer, like let's say for instance, the Sefer Torah is 42 lines. Okay, so if you have a 42-line Megillas Esther, most Nevi'im today are 42 lines as well. So if you have a 42-line Megillas Esther, and you're going to have the Aseres B'nei Haman written according to those shitas that hold that it needs to be written on its own column, so by definition, you're going to have 11 lines taking up the area of 42 lines. At first glance, the way to do that would be to leave a lot of space between each of the lines, right? In other words, you have 11 lines, you have space area of 42 lines worth of height, So how do you get from the top of the column to the bottom of the column? So the Pashut way to do it would be to leave a significant, about around three empty lines of space between each one of the Shemas. The problem with that approach is that some of the Achreinim point out that if somebody does that, then he's creating a sheer parsha between each of the lines. What that means is that if you look in a Sefer Torah, if you look in a Chumash, you'll see that all over you have samachs and peis. What are those samachs and peis? That stands for stuma, psucha, and stuma, which means that there's a parsha, meaning it's a new paragraph in that area. And there's a requisite amount of space that's required between parshios. Now, if one leaves three blank lines between each of the Aseres B'nei Haman, so by definition, you're going to have more than the necessary amount of space to create a parsha. And to create a parsha in an area where there's not meant to be a parsha is something that would passel a Sefer Torah, and certainly for a Megillah is not something that we would want to do. There are those that say that this would not be a problem. And the lumdus behind that is because they say that it's clear that this is not being done for the purpose of a Shir Parsha, and since it's clear that it's not being done for the purpose of a Shir Parsha, it wouldn't present an issue. There's a Tzemach Tzedek that says that, and there are others as well that point that out. Nonetheless, there are Achrayim that are concerned about this, and therefore the Eitzah that's given to avoid this issue is to make the Aseres B'nei Haman very large. So you have 11 lines covering the area of 42 lines, and the way that that's achieved is by having swollen letters. So that would seem to be okay, that solves the problem. Then l'chayr, we're good to go. What's the issue? The issue is that the Vilna Gaon says, in the Bir HaGra, in Shulchan Aruch, in Siman Tav Resh Tzadik Aleph, the Vilna Gaon says that's a shibush. To have Oisius Gedoilos, Oisius Rabasi, as it were, in a place where there's not meant to be an Ois Rabasi. In other words, if you look in the Sefer Torah, for instance, the Beis of Bereshis is a large Ois. That's called an Ois Rabasi. So there's a Mesaira where we're meant to have Oisius Rabasi and where we're not meant to have Oisius Rabasi. So if you put an Ois Rabasi where there's not supposed to be an Ois Rabasi, so the Gaon says that's a Shibush. And since there's no Mesaira telling us that the Aseres B'nei Haman should be larger than the other letters, we don't want to do something that, according to the Gro, would be a shibush. So that brings us back to having the Aseres B'nei Haman on their own column in 11 lines. So if we can't make swollen letters and we can't skip space between the lines, how can you have an Aseres B'nei Haman on its own column? So the only Eitzah would be if the entire Megillah is 11 lines, so then you've solved the problem. Because you can have the Aseres B'nei Haman on its own column. It's the same size lettering as all the other columns. And in that way, you have a very mahuder Megillah. That's the reason why there are many today that are makbid to have an 11-line Megillah. So why would one not have an 11-line Megillah? The teretz is because there are some dinim that are brought in the Rishonim relative to Megillas Esther, and one of those dinim, which is brought in the Hagos Maimoni, Hashem, the Maram Mirotenberg, and the Rabbeinu Tam, is that a Megillah should be just like a Sefer Torah in terms of how many lines it has. So you have a clear instruction from the Rishonim, from multiple Rishonim, stating that a Megillas Esther should be 42 lines as well, just like a Sefer Torah. There's a discussion whether it's 42 lines or 48 lines. That's not our discussion right now. The Minig L'Maisa today is 42 lines, and for the purposes of our discussion, we'll leave it at that, 42 lines. So in as much as we have, in as much as we have Rishonim that clearly state a preferred number of lines, so then it would seem that it would be preferable to do what the Rishonim tell us to do. By doing that, you're going to have to make the Aseres B'nei Haman swollen, and according to the Gra, that's a Shibush. The reply to that is that the Gaon doesn't say anywhere that it would be a psul. The Gaon doesn't say that if somebody makes the Aseres B'nei Haman as Oisius Rabasi, the Megillah is going to be psul. If somebody makes an Oisius Rabasi in middle of a Sefer Torah. That doesn't passel the Sefer Torah. There is one Achman that says that it does, but that's a Das Yochin Mamish. The Pashup Shad is that a nice Rabasi does not passel a Sefer Torah, and certainly Isius Rabasi and a Megillah would not passel the Megillah. The Goyin is just saying that it's a Shibush. Okay, so it's a Shibush. But if I'm able to accomplish what the Agos Maimoni, Marami Rottenberg, and the Rabbeinu Tam prefer of having 42 lines in a Megillah, so if I have to do a Shibush, it would seem that it's not so terrible to do the Shibush of having the Aseres B'nei Haman written as Isius Rabasi. It's worth noting as well that it's clear that the Gaon did not hold of having an 11-line Megillah. The Gaon didn't have an 11-line Megillah. The Gaon had a 42-line Megillah, and his Aseres B'nei Haman were at the bottom of a regular column. So we're chayshish for the shitas that hold that it should be on its own column. That's fine. But if somebody would come to the Vilna Gaon himself with an 11-line Megillah, the Gaon would look at them and say, what's this? He never dreamt of having an 11-line Megillah. So again, there are pros and cons to having an 11-line Megillah. For those that are makbid, that's fine. For those that are not makbid, that's equally fine. The minig definitely in all the dairis, mefurish, and all the achrenim, that the minig in all the dairis was to have a Megillah with many lines, preferably 42, with a large aseres b'nei haman, and many achrenim say not to be mishana from the minig. So it would seem that if somebody wants to do it that way, there's nothing wrong with that. And indeed, today, I think most Megillahs are actually 28 lines. Why 28? There's no real reason why it should be 28. It's just a comfortable size somebody picked. So many Megillahs today are 28 lines with the Isius Rabasi for Aseres B'nei Haman. But if somebody would make it 42 lines with Isius Rabasi for Aseres B'nei Haman, that would be fine as well. Yeah.
Is that problematic to make it 28 if there's no Masorah for that number?
Problematic is a strong word. I wouldn't use the word problematic because it's certainly kosher. There's no shaila, there's no problem. But I would say it's not necessarily preferred. If you have an option to do it either 11 or 42, each of which has a good reason to do it that way, so it would be preferred to make the Megillah in a way where at least you're achieving something halachically rather than making it 28 lines or 21 lines, which although it's very common, doesn't really have any makkah or any reason to do that. Another thing you'll notice in many Megillahs nowadays is that the Aseres B'nei Haman are lined up. They start and end evenly. Similarly, the Ve'eses on the opposite side of the column, they start evenly. If you look at many old Megillahs from 100 years ago, 200 years ago, you'll see that they weren't necessarily makbid about that. And that's a hider that's come into fashion lately, and it's a good thing because there are achrenim that hold that actually would be ma'akiv. So even though clearly the minig was not like those achrenim, and they weren't makbid dafka to have it lined up, but if somebody can have the Aseres B'nei Haman lined up such that it ends evenly, that would be ideal if possible, and there's really no reason not to do that. It's something that's easy to do and can be easily achieved. Another issue relative to the Aseres B'nei Haman and Megillas Esther is the space between the two columns, right? So again, we have the Aseres B'nei Haman on their own column, and it reads, right? V'yes Parshan Dasa, V'yes Parasa, V'yes Adali, V'yes Ari Dasa, right? And you have the Shemus, all the Shemus of the Aseres B'nei Haman on the right side of the column, and all the V'yeses on the left side of the column, and there's space between the two columns. So the question becomes, how much space is required between the two columns? If you look in the Mishnah Berurah and the Shaar HaTzion, the Mishnah Berurah says that it should be kiflayim min haksav. And if you look in the Shaar HaTzion, he quotes as the makor for that Rashi, which is very fascinating because how often do you see in a Shaar HaTzion the makor for a din in the Mishnah Berurah being Rashi? Usually it's Pri Megadim, Shulchan Aruch HaRav, Neid B'Yehuda. The fact is that Rashi does say that there should be kiflayim min haksav between the two columns. And from Rashi until the Mishnah Berurah, there's actually nobody who quotes that Rashi. Mishnah Berurah is the first one to go back and pull that Rashi out of his back pocket and say that one should have kiflayim min haksav between the two columns. It's clear from the Mishnah Berurah, or it's clear from the sugya, that this would not be ma'akiv. There are those that want to say that it's ma'akiv if you don't have kiflayim min haksav between the columns. The pashtus is certainly that it's not ma'akiv. And the question then becomes, there's two questions really. Number one, what does Kiflayim and Aksav mean? And number two, if we're saying it's not Ma'akiv, so how much space is Ma'akiv? So let's deal with the questions one by one. As far as what Kiflayim min Haksav means, there are two opinions regarding what that means. One opinion is that it means Kiflayim of one column. Okay, so you have, let's say, the Shemais in the right column take up, just for argument's sake, let's say 1 inch. Okay, so Kiflayim min Haksav would mean that you need space between the two columns of 2 inches. That's one shita. A second shita, there's actually three shitas. Second shita is that it would be, you take the parshandasa, which is, like we said, let's say an inch. You take the ve'eses, which are on the left side of the column, which is, let's say, a half an inch. So you have a total of an inch and a half. And you double that, and that would be a space of 3 inches. Okay? Sorry, it's two shitas, not three. So those are the two shitas, right? One shita is that you take just one column and you double that, and that's how much space you need. And the second shita is you take the two columns combined and you double that. That would be how much space would be required to be mekayim the din of kiflayim min aksav. What's the shayrish of each of these two opinions? So the shayrish of taking just one column and doubling that is because the lashon of the Gemara when referring to the Aseres Bnei Haman is that they should be written Ariach al gabe levena. So Ariach is half of a levena, right? We have in Bava Basra and in other mesechtas, the Gemara talks about so the sizes of bricks. So one size of a brick is an Ariach, another size of a brick is a levena. It's two different sized bricks, and the levena is double the Ariach. So since the Shemus are called an Ariach, and the Esses are called an Ariach, and the blank space in the middle is called the Levena, so the Levena would have to be double one of the Arichim. If each one is an Ariach, and a Levena is double an Ariach, so then you would just have to double one of the two sides. That's the explanation for that opinion. The other opinion says that since both columns are referred to as the Ariach, and the space is referred to as the Levena, so Levena would have to be double the Arichim. And therefore, you would need double each of the two sides. So like we're saying, if the right side is an inch, left side is a half an inch, and total is an inch and a half, you would need double an inch and a half, which would be 3 inches worth of space between the two columns. There's another raya also to this last opinion that we just mentioned, and that comes from the Netziv. The Netziv says a very beautiful idea. We find that when you're writing a Sefer Torah, how wide is each line supposed to be? So some people think, well, what's the difference as wide as it comes out? But actually, in Halacha, there's a size recommended for the width of the line. What's the size recommended for the width of the line? Gimel pa'amim l'mishpachay seichem. So if the word l'mishpachay seichem has 10 letters, 3 times l'mishpachay seichem is 30 letters. So that means that the ideal size, width of a line is 30 letters worth of space. So the Netziv says, if you have Parshandasa, which is 7 letters, it's the longest of the Aseres Bnei Haman, and you have the S, which is 3 letters, it's a total of 10, and you have Kiflayim and Haksav, so you have double that between the two columns, so that would be 20. 20 and 10 is 30, so you have a perfect size line. So the Netziv says, it's Muchach Mitoichai, that the space between the two columns is going to be double the two columns combined. That's that opinion. Yeah.
The two columns we're talking about are the two sides of the Aseres Bnei Haman?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
The Kiflayim and Haksav comes from where?
The Kiflayim and Haksav comes from Rashi, because the Gemara refers to Ariach and Levena, and if we understand that Levena means, there's another pshat as well, it's Machlokes Rashi and Tosfos, but for the purposes of our discussion, if we understand that the Levena is the blank space in between, so that's the pshat in that. One final issue regarding Megillas Esther, which is worth mentioning, is the size of the margins of Megillas Esther. We find in the Gemara, in the Yerushalmi, that it discusses how large the margins of a Sefer Torah and a Tanakh, a Nach, are meant to be. So let's say you have, in Shul, you have a Sefer Torah, and you have a Sefer Yeshaya that you use for Maftir, for the Aftiras. So how large is the margin of the Sefer Torah meant to be? How large is the margin of the Sefer Yeshaya or the Sefer Shmuel or whichever Sefer you're reading from? How large is that margin meant to be? So it's brought down that the margins for a Sefer Torah are 4 etzbayis on bottom, which according to Reb Chaim Noah is 8 centimeters. 3 etzbayis on top, which according to Reb Chaim Noah is 6 centimeters. So a Sefer Torah should have 8 centimeters on bottom and 6 centimeters on top. What about a Nach? So a Nach is supposed to have 3 centimeters on bottom, 3 etzbayis on bottom and 2 etzbayis on top, which would be 6 and 4. Machlokes, what type of etzba we're talking about, but again, for the purposes of simplifying the discussion, let's just say that a Sefer Torah is meant to have 8 centimeters on bottom and 6 on top, and a Nach is meant to have 6 centimeters on bottom and 4 on top. So the question then becomes, what size are the margins of a Megillas Esther supposed to be? So again, Bashkafa Rishayna, we would think that Megillas Esther is part of Nach, and therefore it should have 3 etzbayis on bottom, 2 on top, which would mean 6 centimeters on bottom and 4 on top. However, we do find that it's brought down in the Torah and many Rishayim and Achrayim that a Megillas Esther is meant has many of the same dinim as a Sefer Torah. There are a number of Rishayim that say the same Maram Rottenberg and Rabbeinu Tam, Hagayis Maimoni, in that same piece, they do mention that a Megillas Esther should have, like we said, 42 lines, and it should also have margins like a Sefer Torah. So therefore, it would be a hider to have a Megillas Esther with margins like a Sefer Torah, although it's important to note that there's a Ran that says not like that, and the Minig seems to be like the Ran, which means that according to the Ran, one would only have to have the sheer Gillian, the margins of the Megillas Esther would only have to be like a Navi and not like a Sefer Torah. And like I'm saying, that seems to be the prevailing minig. There are those, again, that are mahadir to have like a Sefer Torah, and that's great if somebody wants to be mahadir to do
is
that.
Is it a hider?
It's definitely
one or the other. The bigger is better?
Yeah. Yeah. Because you're not losing anything. There's no reason not to do it.
Margin is minimum. These numbers are minimums.
Yeah. Yeah. There is a Shevet HaLevi who learns a different pshat in the Ran. If you're bringing it up already, so I'll mention it. Shevet HaLevi understands from the Ran that you don't need a margin at all. And if you don't need a margin at all, so you can make, a tiny little margin. But L'chayr, that's a very mechudishtik reading of the Ran. The Pashut pshat in the Ran is that the Megillas Esther doesn't have the dinim of a Sefer Torah, but there's no reason to assume that that means to say that it doesn't have the dinim of a Nach either. Pashtus is, the Ran is saying it doesn't have a dinim of a Sefer Torah, so it would have the din of a Nach, like any other Sefer of Nach. That's the Pashut Pshat in the Ran. Okay, so that's just a few words about Megillah. Now, in terms of Tefillin, so this is actually something that I was not planning on mentioning, but Rabbi Orlian put it in the email to talk about it. So, B'les Breira, we'll talk about it a little bit. I got in trouble last time I spoke about it, but that's okay. And that's the different type of ksavim that there are in Stam. Okay, we all know that when writing Stam, so Stam is not written in the typical script that we write with. It's written in what's called Ksav Ashuris. So Ksav Ashuris is a unique type of a Ksav. And within Ksav Ashuris itself, there are different minhagim amongst different sects of Klal Yisrael. Specifically, there's what's called Ksav Beis Yosef, which again, Bahashkafa Rishayna, you would think that Ksav Beis Yosef is the Sfardi Ksav, but that's actually not the case. Ksav Beis Yosef, when it comes to Hilchas Stam, is referring to the Ashkenazi Ksav. And the reason is because the Ashkenazi Ksav is the Ksav that's brought in the Beis Yosef. So since that's the ksav that's brought in the Beis Yosef, so ksav of Ashkenazim is known as ksav Beis Yosef. Now, there is a variant of ksav Ashkenaz, and that's what's known as ksav Arizal. The Arizal, who actually lived together at the same time as the Beis Yosef, they were together in Tzfas, and the Arizal, while he's maskim to using ksav Beis Yosef, for particular letters, he says to write them differently. And there are a number of such letters, the Aleph, the Vav, the Ayin, the Shin, some say the Ches and the Tes, there's a machlekes about that, but most notably is the Tzadik. Why is it most notable? Because in the other letters, the variation of the Arizal is minor. When it comes to the Tzadik, the way that the Arizal wanted it written is actually quite different from the way that regular standard Ashkenaz Ksav Beis Yosef writes it. Regular standard Ashkenaz Ksav Beis Yosef writes a tzaddik as a conglomerate of a nun with a yud on top of it. Okay, if you're able to see a tzaddik on your computer or anywhere in a siddur, you take a look, you'll see it's sort of a nun. Okay, draw one. This is a typical regular Arizal, Ksav Beis Yosef Tzadik. Okay, there you go. According to the Arizal, now, again, the main point to focus on over here is that you have a nun with a yud on top of the nun. The Arizal makes two changes. What are the two changes? Correct. Over here, the nun is a standard Ashkenaz nun, which means that the tzavar, the neck, is coming out of the center of the left head, and the yud is a forward-facing yud. Whereas in Ksav Arizal, the nun is written like a Sfaradi nun, which means that the tzavar is coming out of the right side of the head, but more importantly, the right head is backwards. Okay? It's what's called a yud hafucha, a backward yud. Now, that raises... Yeah?
How did this machlokas get left until like so recently? Aren't there sifrei Torah that are older than that come from the Gemara?
So that's a very good question. And the answer is that... Well, there are two things. First of all, before the time of the Beis Yosef, you don't have much from the Rishonim describing how the letters are written. Okay? In other words, only in the times of the later Rishonim did the Rishonim begin to record how the letters are meant to be written. And all the Rishonim who record how the letters are meant to be written, I think Reb Chaim Kanievsky in his Sefer lists off 11 Rishonim, they all talk about the tzaddik facing forward, like ours, like the regular Ashkenaz tzaddik. Only when the Arizal came along did the Arizal say to switch it. It's clear from the Arizal that he agreed that until that point, the Pashtus was that it would be forward, and he was saying to make a shinui, al pi Kabbalah, for whatever reasons the Arizal had, he felt that it should be written differently, and the yud should be backward. So, in terms of your question of what they did until then, that wasn't the issue. All the Rishonim seemed to have agreed that it should be forward. The Arizal was coming along and saying to do it differently. So that's Ksav Arizal. There's a third type of a Ksav, and that's what's called the Sfardi Ksav, which is known as Ksav Velish. Why it's called Velish is an interesting discussion. Nobody really knows for sure. There are some theories, though. Ksav Velish is the Sfardi Ksav. Those are the three primary ksavim, and like everything else in Yiddishkeit, everybody should stick with their minig. So who uses ksav velish? Like we said, that's the Sfaradim. Who uses ksav beis Yosef? That's the Ashkenazim. So who's left? The Chassidim. The Chassidim, who are Ashkenazim, they go with the ksav of the Arizal. And until today, Chassidim use ksav Arizal, Ashkenazi non-Hasidim use Ksav Beis Yosef, and Sfaradim use Ksav Velish. Like everything else in Yiddishkeit, everybody should stick to their minig. All three minhagim are quite mevusas, have hundreds of years of Mesaira behind them, and everybody should try and stick with their Mesaira. Yes?
Is the altar of this Ksav, is that a variant of one of these Ksav, or is it its own category?
That's why I didn't want to talk about it. The Alter Rebbe's Ksav is a variant of Ksav Arizal. It's like a subdivision of Ksav Arizal. It's basically Ksav Arizal. It is Ksav Arizal. That's really what it is. But it looks a little bit different. Stylistically, it's a little bit different. Many say that it's not. There's really no such thing as Alter Rebbe Ksav. It's really just the old Russian Ksav. Chabad is a Russian Chassidus. And if you look at the old Russian Sifrei Torah, that's how the old Russian Sifrei Torah looked. So, but today, we're not in Russia. Today we're here, or in Eretz Yisrael, or wherever. There's not so many Russian Sifrim around from 150 years ago. But that's what's known as the Alter Rebbe's Ksav. So again, everybody should try and stick with their minig. That's the ideal thing. I will mention again what I got in trouble for last time, and that is when it comes to the Alter Rebbe's Ksav, it's very difficult to write it in a halachically pure manner, and therefore only if the Stam was written by an expert cipher should it be used. But if it was written by somebody who's not necessarily so talented or not necessarily so knowledgeable, often there can be problems that are found, particularly in that Ksav, as opposed to the other Ksavim. Ksav Sfarad also, Sfaradi, Ksav Elish also, that you can sometimes get into. It's more common to find problems in that Ksav as well, because of the Nuns. There are particular letters in different Ksavim that are harder or easier to write. And again, everyone should try and primarily stick to their own minig. But if you get called up for an aliyah in a shul where the Sefer Torah there is not kefi your minig, that's perfectly fine. You can take the aliyah. You don't have to worry about it. Even if you're wearing some of the achrenim talk about what if you're wearing Beis Yosef tefillin and you get called up to a Sefer Torah in Ksav Arizal, so it's a tarti de sasri. But the haskamas achrenim is that that's not a chshash. And it would be perfectly acceptable to take an aliyah from a Sefer Torah in a Ksav other than your own, even if you're wearing tefillin kefi your Mesaira. Yeah?
Are they usually exclusive? Meaning, the people who think, you know, it should be Ksav, they think the other two are possible?
That's a very good question. It's clear that all agree that Ksav Beis Yosef is kosher. And therefore, Stipler held and Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky held that if somebody doesn't have a minig, he's a bal tshuva or a ger or whatever it may be, so he should use Ksav Beis Yosef, because that's the Ksav, like you're asking, that's the Ksav that everybody agrees is okay. Once you're dealing with the other three Ksavim that we mentioned, whether it's Arizal, Velish, or Chabad, all of them have this backward tzadi. And once all of them have this backward tzadi, then you're getting into a bit of a discussion in the achrenim. Most achrenim hold that the backwards tzadi is kosher as well, but there is a vocal and prominent minority of achrenim that feel that the backward tzadi is not kosher at all. Therefore, ideally, if somebody has the minig of the Beis Yosef, he should really try and stick to Beis Yosef to avoid getting into any potential machlekes, even though it's clear that most Achrayim feel that the Arizal Tzadi is kosher as well, even for somebody whose minig is Beis Yosef. Now, in terms of Hilchas Tefillin, so that's what we discussed about the Ksavim, that these are obviously very important things for Rabbanim to be aware of, because if you're going to be a Rav of a community, a Sfaradi community, or a Litvisha community, or a Chassidisha community, whatever it is, you have to know what type of Ksav your community really should ideally be using. Now, when it comes to tefillin, so we wear tefillin every day, and not so many people ask their Rav where the tefillin should best be placed, but if the Rav is a good Rav, he should be aware of where the tefillin should be placed. And since many people, unfortunately, don't necessarily always have the tefillin in the correct place, it would be ideal if the Rav could try to speak about it a little bit, give shiurim about it, educate the tzibur about it a little bit, because like we're saying, there's a lot of people, if you look around in shul, many people, unfortunately, don't have the tefillin in the right place. Even if somebody spent a lot of money and he has a very beautiful, very expensive pair of tefillin, if he's not wearing it in the correct area, the correct spot on the guf, then he's getting into serious shilas of whether he's yaitzah the mitzvah or not. So in terms of the shel yad, it's meant to be on the muscle. It's meant to be on the muscle. Now, where on the muscle? So that's a discussion. Some say, notably the Vilna Gaon, that it could be anywhere on the muscle. If it could be anywhere on the muscle, so that gives a person a lot of leeway in terms of how high up the tefillin can ride. Others say, most notably the Ramah and the Shulchan Aruch as well, although some want to say that that's not the Pshat in the Shulchan Aruch, so we'll just leave it at the Ramah. The Ramah clearly says that it should be, if you take the bone which runs from the elbow to the shoulder, and you take the midpoint of the bone, so the tefillin shel yad should be below the midpoint of the bone until the bottom of the muscle. So according to the Ramah, you have significantly less space to play around with. All agree that if the tefillin are placed below the muscle, meaning closer to the elbow, and part of the tefillin is below the muscle, then the pashtus is that one is not mekayim the mitzvah. And if you look around, you'll see many, many people, especially people with larger tefillin, but even people with regular-sized tefillin, that have the tefillin low down on the muscle such that it's actually pretty near the elbow. And if somebody's wearing his tefillin in that manner, like we're saying, it's highly questionable if he's mekayim the mitzvah at all. Yeah?
If someone has shorter arms, there's a b'chor not that much space between the middle of the bone and the bottom of the muscle. Like, there might not even be enough space for...
Correct. So that's most commonly found by bar mitzvah boys. And there are two ways of dealing with that issue. One way of dealing with the issue is to make a smaller shel yad. Okay, in other words, you can have a shel rosh one size, and you can have a shel yad another size. For the purposes of this discussion, I actually took the liberty of bringing along just such a pair. Since I anticipated that question. Here you have a shel reish. If you take a look at the shel reish, you'll see it's a standard size shel reish. It's a regular standard shel reish. If you look around shul, this is what 99% of people in shul have. If you take a look at this shel yad, you'll see that it's significantly smaller than the shel reish. Okay? And what's the reason to make a smaller shel yad? The reason why some people make a smaller shel yad is exactly because of the reason that you just asked about. Okay, if somebody wants to be makbid for the shita of the Ramah, to have it dafka on the lower half of the bone, but still have it on the muscle, then one has to be very, very careful about the placement of the tefillin, because like we said, if it goes too low, then you're not mekayim the mitzvah at all. So by having a smaller shel yad, that would be a way to alleviate that issue.
And this problem is even if part of it is below the muscle.
No, correct.
Any part of it is below the muscle.
Correct. Even a miyut. Yes. So that's one way of dealing with the issue. The other way of dealing with the issue is simply by saying that we're going to rely on the shita of the gra. If you rely on the shita of the gra, so then you have the entire muscle, and even by a bar mitzvah boy, there's plenty of room. If you're dealing with the entire muscle, as long as he's careful about where he's placing it, you have plenty of room, even for a regular-sized pair of tefillin, and that would not be an issue. I'll just mention parenthetically that the shita of the Gaon is, I mean, it's not for me to stick my head between the Gaon and the Ramah, but if you just look at the sugya, the Shita of the Gain is definitely the Pashtus. The Ramah is a tremendous, tremendous chiddush. To say that it has to be on the lower half of the bone, the Ramah is basing himself on a smag, and it's very difficult to read the Ramah's Shita into the smag. The Pashtus is definitely like the Gra. And therefore, David Feinstein, Reb Chaim Kanievsky, and others felt that there's nothing wrong with relying on the Shita of the Gra, and you have the entire muscle to work with. But again, for somebody who wants to be medactic, to be Mekayim all the dais, there is room, if you would like to be Mahader, to make a smaller Shalyad. And if you make a smaller Shalyad, so then you have the best of all worlds. Perhaps the most common question that a Rav is going to be asked regarding Hilchas Tefillin is, I'm getting new Ritzuas, or I'm buying Tefillin for my son. Should I get all black Ritzuas, or should I get the traditional black and white ones like these? The shayrish of the question is as follows. There's a halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai that the Ritzuas have to be black. Now, what does that mean? How black do they have to be? Does the entire thing have to be black? Does it have to be 99.7% black? 90% black, 51% black. What does that mean, that the tefillin have to be black? Specifically, let's say I have a couple of white spots somewhere in my ritzua, am I all of a sudden now not yoytze the mitzvah? Because there's halacha l'mesh mi-Sinai that the ritzua has to be black. So the Achrayim talk about this, and the Mishneh Berurah is, the Bir Halacha, more specifically, is very, very machmir. And he leaves it as a tzarachian. It's not clear to the Bir Halacha if somebody has one white spot on his ritzua, he has it sad to say that one might not be yaitz of the mitzvah. So that's very scary, because most people with ritzuas which are black and white, there are areas of the ritzua that wears out, and once it wears out, so the paint rubs off, and you can have white spots on the ritzua. Most commonly along the edges, but sometimes in the middle as well. Certainly at the end of the shalyad, where you wrap them and you tuck them in, the ritzua gets worn out over there and the paint comes off all the time. Also in the area where you tighten the ritzua by the shalyad, also Mishneh Berurah himself says over there that it's very common for the paint to rub out. So that's very scary. If someone's faced with the prospect of not being yaitz of the mitzvah, so people can become neurotic about this. You're going to have to check your tefillin every single day, and you're going to have the markers, and you're going to have to paint it all the time, and it's a frightening idea. So to try and ease people's ability to be mekayim the mitzvah according to all shitas, they thought of a brilliant idea. If you take the ritzua and you soak it, instead of painting it, if the ritzua naturally is not black, which obviously it's not, so you're painting it black. So once the paint rubs off, you're back to the white. It's like if you have a vanilla cake with a chocolate icing. So if you take off the icing, what's underneath? White. Okay, so it's the same thing with ritzua. If you have a white ritzua painted black and the black comes off, what's underneath? White. But if you have a chocolate cake with a chocolate icing, and you cut into the cake, the inside of the cake is also going to be black. It's not just the top. So it's the same thing with the ritzua. If you soak the ritzua in the paint, as opposed to painting the ritzua with the paint, so then the entire ritzua becomes saturated with the black dye, and even if it rubs out on the top, what's going to be left underneath is also going to be black. So you're never going to come to a shaila of not being yoytze the mitzvah. That's the reason for the invention of the all-black ritzuas, which have become very popular in the last 20 years or so. So why wouldn't somebody get such ritzuas? The answer is as follows. There's two reasons. Number one is because, first of all, you find many rishonim who say clearly, there is a Rambam who indicates that the back of the ritzua should be black. And you find many Rishonim that say that that's not the minig, and Achrayim. So it's clear that the minig for many Dairis, for the last 1,000 years, was to have the front of the ritzua black and the back of the ritzua white. Therefore, if somebody is going to make an all-black ritzua, he's changing, really, the minig of the last 1,000 years. So that's one reason. The second reason is because we mentioned before that although the Mishneh Berurah, the Bir Halacha, is mitzaded lahachmir, that the entire ritzua needs to be black, however, all the other achrenim that talk about the shayla seem to indicate that one would be able to rely on roiv. So even if the ritzua would be 51% black, but you have areas that are faded out, you would still be mekayim the mitzvah, because you have a lot more than 51%. You have 90-95% of your ritzua which is black, and according to all the other achrenim that discuss this question, it would seem that one would be able to rely on that. So for these two reasons, one need not be extra careful to dafka get the all-black ritzuas. But again, if somebody wants to get the all-black ritzuas, there certainly is a mokim to get them to avoid getting into any potential shayla. And as far as changing from the minig, so Rabbi Eliashiv himself in the beginning was very against this new ritzua because he felt it's a shine from the minig. But now that we're almost at the level where the minig has become to have all-black, so his opposition declined because he felt that it wasn't such a pirtza anymore because so many thousands of people are doing it. So either way is acceptable. If somebody wants to get the black and white ones, that's terrific. If somebody wants to get the all black ones, that would be fine as well. In terms of batim, if somebody asks about purchasing batim, so batim is a very complicated issue to discuss because it's really, yeah, you have a question?
Yeah, can I ask on this topic?
Yeah, sure.
Is there still the chatchila, even according to the Rishonim, you say you rely upon rov, if it did chip, you should paint it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you certainly should paint it, but you don't have to check it every single day.
If you notice it, you should paint it.
Once a month, let's say, every Rosh Chodesh, a person could take a look at his ritzuas and deal with it in that manner. But you don't have to check it every single day and be neurotic about it.
Is there ever an need to get new ritzuas?
Yeah. If they're taka fading out so much so that you find yourself painting them all the time, which certainly happens, then it would be kedai to get new ritzuas. Because again, even the ones that say that you can rely on Rav, not all of them are so happy about it. Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnefeld, for instance, he says that Efshe, you could be Saimach on Rav, but it's not like he's excited about it. So if somebody can have an all-black ritzua, that's certainly ideal. Shlaim Zalman Arbach, he says that it's kind of like an esrik. He says you look at it, you know, at an arm's length, and if it looks black, it's fine. You don't have to start examining it, you know, looking for white spots. That's not necessary. Only if from this distance you see a white spot, so then you should paint it. Batim is a very complicated subject because it's something that unless you are a batimacher, it's very rare to find somebody, no matter how chashav a rav he may be, who really is knowledgeable and understanding in the mitzias of the batim. And therefore, it's very difficult to give just general guidelines about batim, since we're talking about something which is, like I'm saying, unless you're in the field, it's very difficult to have a handle on what it is that we're talking about. So the best advice that one can give as a rav to a congregant who wants to buy tefillin would be to buy batim either with a very good hashkacha, or from a well-known batimacher, you know, who's considered to be higher end. Because the fact of the matter is that amongst the less expensive batim and the less good hashkachas, there are tremendous, tremendous amount of problems in batim nowadays. And therefore, like I'm saying, somebody should try and either buy from a well-known higher end batimacher or to buy batim with a very good hashkacha. Yeah.
If a person has a limited budget and they're going to spend either more money on Mehudadika Parshios or more money on a higher-end batim, how would it fall out?
It's an impossible question to answer because if the batim are not kosher, the tefillin are not kosher, and if the Parshios are not kosher, the tefillin are also not kosher. So they're equally important. To say that there are more problems in Batim than there are in Parshiyos might be true. Although if somebody, like I'm saying, is getting a more expensive bias, or you're saying he has a limited budget. If he has a limited budget, I don't know. It's an impossible question to answer.
See us now, right now, 2023, March. What are the price ranges that would we feel confident in it? So in America, that the higher end, you'd be confident that that's the right range.
It's hard to find batim today that are truly mahuder for less than $800 or $900 as of March 2023. Any bias that's selling for $400, $500, $600 is likely highly problematic. And the same goes with parshiyos. The price is the same. Anything $900, $800, $900 or more should be, I'm not saying it is, but should be of a decent standard. Less than that, it's going to be very, very difficult. Another point is as follows. Somebody's buying a pair of tefillin for $1,500 today, it's unlikely that he's getting anything that's really mahuder. It's not likely. I'm saying a few short years ago, the prices were very different, but today those are the prices. Yeah.
When we say mahuder in this context, are we talking about, like, everyone is a kind of mitzvah, it's just a matter of whether you have the hijra and whatever it does?
So that's a very good question, which is has come to the forefront recently due to various tumults that have come up in different parts of the world. And there are those that say that, well, I don't need mahuder. As long as it's kosher, that's okay. The problem is that if you're dealing, let's say, with kashrus, with food, okay, so you can set up a factory to standards that are not okay. Okay according to a myriad of opinions, okay according to most opinions, or okay according to most opinions, or okay according to all opinions, right? So that depends on the mashgiach and the hashgacha of what standard they want to implement in this factory, what's reasonable, what's doable, and they can then choose to set up the factory in that manner. And if they're honest and you ask them, they'll tell you, well, no, it's not mahuder, but it's lechatchila, right? Or maybe it is mahuder, whatever it may be. When it comes to stam, you're dealing with a sefer. If the sefer is an erlicha person and he knows the halachas well, there's no reason why he can't write to a mahuder standard. So anytime you're dealing, somebody says, well, yeah, his parshiyos, they're kosher. Yeah, they're not mahuder, but they're kosher. Well, why is he writing that way? There's no normal sefer who lechatchila is going to write in a not mahuder fashion. There's no such thing. So the point is that if something is lechatchila not mahuder, it's because it happened to have come out that way usually. But generally speaking, if a sefer is a reliable sefer and a knowledgeable sefer, and he's a medaktik b'halacha, his parshiyos will be mahuder. And if he's not, well, then there's a good chance that they might not be kosher at all, because that means that he's not a knowledgeable person. He doesn't know the halachas properly. And if he doesn't know the halachas properly, then it's inevitable that he's going to produce a certain percentage of his stam, which is could be potentially very highly problematic or not kosher at all. So it's a very tricky topic. In batim, if you have a batim factory, one could theoretically say, like we were talking about by food, that I'm setting up the factory in a way where we're producing batim to X standard and not to Y standard. So there it's more reasonable that somebody could do such a thing. But when it comes to writing parshiyos, it's not really a relevant topic.
When you have a klaf, you could take it to a sofer to check to see if it's a good klaf or not a good klaf, good klaf, puzzle kosher. When you have a bias, that batim that have already been manufactured, painted over, is there any way to discern if it was made with tefillah that there were gaps and they put in glue instead of the leather or other things that might be problematic or puzzle?
So there's two answers to the question. There's three answers to the question. There are many things that are you'll never know. it's impossible to know. For instance, on the side of the batim, you have the shin, right? So there's a halacha called chaktoiches. Very, very briefly, chaktoiches means that the shin has to be created through a means known as ksiva, and not through a means known as chakika. Chakika means that if you have, let's say, a mold where you have an indented shin, and you put it against a piece of putty, so, and then you pull off the mold, you'll have a shin there. How did that shin come into being? By itself. It wasn't written. You didn't have somebody pushing up from the back. That would be chakireches, or forming the form of a shin. It just happened, right? So that, like making cookies with a cookie cutter. That's chakteches, right? So if the shin was made with chakteches or chakireches or ksiva, there's no way anybody can ever know. So that's that type of thing is impossible to know. There are other things that a good batimacher, a real expert batimacher, can look at a bias like this and say, no, this is problematic. And he can point out different things that are problematic. More frequently, if you open up the bias and you look at the inside of the bias, there's more that you can see as well. But in terms of your question of, let's say, what Rabbi Orlean was referring to is that there was a big scandal about 40 years ago where the tefillin have to be square, okay? Now, tefillin is made from leather, which is pressed together and formed into a perfect square. Now, since it's made from leather, the nature of the pressure is such that there are going to be gaps. It's like if you take a Play-Doh and you take presses and you press them on either side, right? It's not going to be a perfect square. There are going to be ridges and gaps because it's a malleable surface, okay? So how do you get it to be square? So a reliable Erlich HaBatimacher will pull the leather to make sure that it fills in all the gaps, that the gaps are filled in with the leather itself and the bias is actually square. Someone who's less Erlich will simply take some glue, fill in the gaps with glue, and then just paint it over. So once it's black, you'll never know if your bias is really kosher or not. Because if it's filled in, if those gaps are filled in with glue and just painted over, then the tefillin are not kosher. So they did find many batim like that 40 years ago. It was a very big scandal. Until today, there are people that do that. But once the bias is painted, there's really no way to know if that's how it was made unless you strip the paint, which some people do. If it happens that somebody gets the tefillin from someone and then they find out later that that person had an issue with the glue, you could theoretically strip the paint and have a look and see whether it's really all square from the bias itself or whether there's glue filling in the gaps. Yeah.
Are batim made today with like machines?
Yeah, definitely. But it depends what you mean by machines. There are machines and there are machines. I assume what you mean to ask is avodas yad or not avodas yad. So what that means is that just like, right, Pesach is coming up, so you can make matzahs by hand, you can make what's called machine matzahs. So there was a whole tumult 160 years ago, 170 years ago, about machine matzahs, whether machine matzahs are kosher or not. The issue is because matzahs have to be made l'shem matzahs mitzvah. If a machine is making it, so where's your lishma? You're missing out on your lishma. So some said at that time that pushing the button is lishma, and therefore the matzahs are 100% mahoder. And others said that what does pushing the button help? You're not making the matzahs, the machine is making the matzah. So that was a machlekes then, and it's still a machlekes today. So when it comes to making batim, there are different machines that can be used in the making of the batim, which could be powered by electricity, but the more expensive batim are made by what's known as avodas yad. Now, even the avodas yad batim use, for lack of a better term, machines. However, the big difference is that the machines that are used by avodas yad batimachers are machines that are powered by the human body and not by electricity. How does that work? They take a bicycle and they hook up the bicycle to the machine, and by pedaling the pedals of the bicycle, that spins the wheels, which powers the machine, and through that you're able to cut the bias and form the bias and do all types of things. So that's known as, jokingly, some people call it avodas regel, but that's avodas yad. Avodas yad today is generally powered by pedaling. Yeah.
That's more because, like, let's say 2,500 years ago, 2,000 years ago, so like they also obviously had kosher bantim, they didn't have any of these kind of utensils.
Correct. So the reason is because in those days they made tefillin from what's known as dakais. Dakais are kishmam kein hu, smaller, thinner animals like sheep or goats. So they made tefillin from dakais. The advantage of dakais is that it was much less expensive, it's much easier to make, could be made much quicker in a very mahoder fashion, and life was great. The chisaron of the dakais batim is that they went bad very quickly because they were dakais. So they weren't strong, they weren't tough, they didn't have a long shelf life. People would replace their tefillin every few years. What changed, which in turn required machinery, is that now they use gases, meaning cows, bulls, cows, which is very, very strong leather. It's much thicker, much stronger, and the advantage of it is that it can last a lifetime. Instead of having to change your tefillin every few years, can have tefillin that can last a lifetime, but it necessitated all these types of machines coming into use. So that's when machinery came into the picture. But you're right, 200 years ago, there were no machines involved in making batim. Somebody would just sit in his basement and in an hour could make a bias. I'm saying it took longer, you had to dry it out, whatever, but the actual work was relatively quick and simple. A very, very common question that a rabbi is going to be asked when it comes to batim is, are my batim meruba, right? You have to have square batim, and everybody's always nervous that their batim are not square, either because the four compartments of the shelresh, right? You see over here, there are four compartments in the shelresh, so they can start to spread apart. They start to spread apart, right? You see over here, actually, right? There's a bit of a gap. So if the batim start to spread apart to the extent that the tefillin are no longer square, then the tefillin are not going to be kosher. So people are nervous often that their tefillin are not square, number one. And number two, sometimes people, their tefillin can bang. They can get a bang, right? If somebody drops their tefillin, a corner can get a bang, or if they're davening Shemini Esrei and they bow maidim into a pole, so their tefillin can get a bang. And people are nervous about the ribua. So Rabbi Eliyahu Gitman is a Yid in Yerushalayim who made batim for Rebbe Eliashiv, and he spent, I think, 8 years asking Rebbe Eliashiv questions about Hilchas Batim every day. So he once told me that he came to Rebbe Eliashiv with a bias that the corner wasn't sharp. And he asked Rebbe Eliashiv, is it a shaila in the ribua? So Rebbe Eliashiv said, no, it's not a problem. So he's a bit of a character, this Rabbi Gitman. He took a hammer out of his jacket pocket, and he banged the bias in the corner. He showed it to Rebbe Eliashiv. He said, is it a problem now? Rebbe Eliashiv looked at the bias and said, no, it's still fine. He took the hammer again, banged it again. Is it a problem now? I don't remember the story exactly. I don't remember if it was the second or third time that he banged it with the hammer when Rebbe Eliashiv said, oh, now it's a problem. So the point of the story is that when people get nervous that their corners are not sharp, it's okay. 99% of the time it's perfectly fine. The tefillin just have to have a general square appearance, and that's fine. You don't have to be able to cut your finger on the corner in order to say that it's meruba. So that's in terms of batim. One other point that I'd like to mention, which is important, is when we're dealing with ribua, we're dealing with three parts of the bias. I think a lot of people don't know this, and correct me if I'm wrong. There are three parts of the bias that have to be square. You have this part, which is the base of the tefillin. This is called the titura. Okay? The titura has to be square. You also see in the titura, you have tefiris, you have stitching. There's a din. All of these three are halacha l'moshe m'Sinai, we paskin. Okay? The stitching also needs to be perfectly square. You have stitching on the bottom over here, and you have the other side of the stitching on the top. The stitching also has to be perfectly square, and the tower of the tefillin, the top part, also has to be perfectly square, which is known as the ktsitsa. So all three parts of the tefillin have to be meruba. Now, what's the gether of meruba? When is let's say you find that your titura, the base of the tefillin, is not perfectly square. Okay, so how not perfectly square makes it unkosher? So there's a there's a famous thing that many Rabbanim say, that as long as it's less than 1 millimeter off, it's still kosher. In other words, let's say you have 50 millimeters going in this direction. I'm not saying let's say for no reason. Generally, it's 50 millimeters, right? So let's say you have 50 millimeters going in this direction, and you have 48 millimeters going in this direction, so it's off by more than a millimeter. So they say that's a psul. But if it's, let's say, 50 and 49 and a half, then it's kosher, right? The same thing over here. As long as it's within a millimeter, it's okay. That's what people say. But that is a very, very terrible mistake. And the reason is because there's no Rishon that says, or Achron, that if it's within a millimeter, it's okay. Where did this millimeter idea come from? Right? They didn't have millimeters in Russia in the 1600s and in Poland in the 1800s. So where did this idea of the millimeter come from? So it comes from the following, that the Gemara says, and it's quoted in Shulchan Aruch, that kol amsa b'ribua is amsa v'trei chumshi b'alach sayna, that something that's an amma squared is an amma and two-fifths in the diagonal. Now, if you make the mathematical equation, you'll find that that chazal is off by 1%. By 1%, I believe. Maybe it's 2%. By 2%, I think. It's off by 2%. Okay? So the Achrenim say that we see from here that as long as it's within 2%, it's still considered to be square. Okay? Again, because chazal are saying that if it's an amma square, it's an amma and two-fifths on the diagonal. And if you make the mathematical equation, an amma and two-fifths in the diagonal is 2% incorrect. So they understand from there that as long as you're within 2%, you're still okay. That's still called square. So therefore, if you have 50 millimeters going in this direction, and 50 millimeters going in this direction, that's a perfect square. But if it's off by more than 2%, then it's not going to be square. So that's great, right? That's true. So that means if you have 50 and 49.1, you're within 2% and the tefillin are going to be kosher. But that does not translate into the stitching, nor the ketzitza on top, because the stitching is smaller than 50 millimeters, right? You only have, let's say, 46 millimeters in the stitching. And in the ketzitza, you only have about 34 millimeters in the ketzitza. So this cheshbon, this idea that as long as it's less than a millimeter off, it's kosher, is not always true. That only applies to the standard bias and the standard titura. But if someone has a smaller than standard titura, even much less than a millimeter would be a problem. And similarly, on the stitching and on the ktsitsa, certainly less than a millimeter would be a problem. Now, another thing that's important to know is that it's famous, B'Shem Rav Moshe Feinstein and Chazon Ish and many other achronim of recent generations, that there is no shear. As long as it looks square, it's square. Okay, so you look at the bias, if it looks square, it's kosher. If it doesn't look square, it's not kosher. So how does that jive with this idea of the 2%? So it seems to me that the Pashut Pshat is that we have Chazal over here being kaveh for us, that if it's more than 2%, then the average person will notice it. Okay, or at least somebody who's tuned in will notice it. But if it's within 2%, then even somebody who's tuned in may not notice it. So it seems that it's not necessarily a stira. This idea that it's tully in Re'iya Sainayim, and this idea that it's tully in 2%, L'chaira, is lav dafka a stira. Yeah?
If you were to show it to a bunch of people and they would say it looks square, but it is off at 1%.
Tzarechian. Okay. Tzarechian. Now, moving on to mezuzah. Yeah?
The raya from the square with
Yeah.
Doesn't that raya assume that Chazal would have given you like a perfect number to the fact that they didn't choose the author? Because the process Chazal just didn't have a way to communicate like that number, which is basically squared of 2. So how can we say from there, oh, you see from here, you could be 2% off. There was no way to get to 1.41, et cetera.
But you see, what you're saying is true, but you see that Chazal didn't go through the trouble of saying that it's not meduyik. No, they're just leaving you with that number. Now, even if you're saying they didn't have a way to communicate a precise number, but they did have a way to tell you that it's imprecise, and they chose not to. So from the fact that they just left it at that, it is indicative that Chazal felt that that's fine, that's enough. So it's a good question, but l'chari, that's the answer. Now, mezuzah is an area that Rabbanim get asked questions all the time, and we can give a three-day shiur just on mezuzah.
We have shiur on mezuzah in terms of placement and in terms of where to put it, but in terms of stam aspect, we didn't.
Aha, okay, yeah.
If I have a follow-up question on tefillin.
Yeah, sure.
Just, it's a common question regarding traveling and bringing tefillin into the airport, the restroom, and these things. And
I just did it a few times, yeah.
Right.
So as long as it's wrapped, I mean, when you're taking tefillin into a restroom in the airport, generally your tefillin are wrapped at least 3 or 4 or 5 times, right? You have them in the plastic cases, which some say is not enough, because you still have the ksharim, not in the case. But you have the tefillin bag. You have the tefillin bag on top of that. You have the plastic on top of that. You have your carry on top of that. So generally, there's enough to keep it safe. Also, there's another inyan, is that if you leave it outside of the bathroom, who knows what's going to happen to it. So the pashtus is, if I'm not mistaken, that it would be permitted to take the tefillin in with you.
And let's say in the back of a car.
I mean, you see in the Gemara in Brachas says Lahedya that the Amoraim took the tefillin into the bathroom with them. Yeah.
In the back of a car, in a car mechalal, is it okay if the tefillin, the outer bag, is on directly on the floor?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not recommending it.
Maybe
it's not a it's not a mitzvah to put your tefillin on the floor. But
yeah.
If you want to know halachically, is it a problem? Pashtus, it would not be, purely halachically speaking, it wouldn't be a problem. Okay, so you just knocked out half of what I was going to say about mezuzah. So we'll try and deal, but it's okay because we don't have that much time left anyway. So I'll try and deal just with the stam aspects of mezuzah, which I don't have anything written down about, but that's okay. A very interesting stam aspect of mezuzah, which almost nobody knows anything about, at least people who are not in the field, is what's called the Shir Parsha. We mentioned before regarding Sifrei Torah that Sifrei Torah have parshias, right, which are paragraphs between different sections of the Torah. And there are two types of sections. There's what we call the psucha and what we call a stuma. And a psucha and a stuma have different requirements in terms of how much space needs to be left between the two paragraphs in order to ensure that it's a properly made psucha or a properly made stuma. Now, when it comes to mezuzah, so a mezuzah, well, let's back up before mezuzah, tefillin. When it comes to tefillin, so tefillin have to be written between Shema and V'hayim Shemaya, you need a stuma. You need a parsha stuma there. Now, the problem is that there's a machlokes between the Rambam and the Rush. There is a very good sefer, by the way, which goes through this discussion about the psuchas and the stumas with very good pictures on the topic. And it's probably kedai to take a look over there to get a better idea of exactly how to make a psucha and how to make a stuma according to the Rambam and the Rush. But for this purposes of our discussion, there's a machlekes between the Rambam and the Rush how to create a parsha stuma. Okay, between Shema and V'hayim Shema, you need a stuma. And there's a machlekes Rambam and the Rush how to create a stuma. Now, the consensus of the Rishonim and Achreinim is that when writing a Sefer Torah, since the Rambam and the Rush both give multiple ways that one can create a stuma, and there is one way that the Rambam and the Rush give which works according to both of them, so when writing a Sefer Torah, one should write the same applies for the psuchas, one should write all the psuchas and all the stumas in a manner that's kosher according to the Rambam and according to the Rush. Okay, and in the Sefer Torah, that can be done. And indeed, that's the minig ad hayom hazeh. We make all our Sefer Torah with parashiyos psuchas and stumas in a manner that conforms to the opinion of both the Rambam and the Rush. The problem is, when making tefillin, it seems to be impossible. Why? Because the manner where one... Here, I'll make a picture for you. Okay, this is a manner where you can make a parsha stuma, which is good according to the Rambam and according to the Rush. Okay, meaning that you have writing at the beginning of the line, you have writing at the end of the line, and you have a blank space in the middle of the line. So that's a way that somebody can make a parsha stuma that's kosher according to everybody. The problem is that when you have Shema and Bahayim Shemaya in tefillin, when someone's writing tefillin, so you have four parshias. You have Kadesh, Bahaya Kiviyafa, Shema, and Bahayim Shemaya. Now, since Shema and Bahayim Shemaya is the area that you need a parsha stuma, but they're not on the same line, so there's no way to create a parsha stuma that works according to the Rambam and according to the Rush. So this is quite a problem. This is a halachic conundrum that Paiskim have dealt with. So the Mechaber in Shulchan Aruch says that the halacha is like the Rambam. Everybody agrees that the Iker halacha is like the Rambam. And since the Iker halacha is like the Rambam, so the way that you would make the Parsha Stuma that's good according to the Rambam is that you have Shema going more or less until the end, and you have Ayam Shemaya starting from the middle of the line. And if you do that, so it's true that it'll be a Psucha according to the Rush, but it's a stuma according to the Rambam, and the Iker Halacha is according to the Rambam, and therefore that's what the Mechaber says to do, and that's the minig of Sfaradim until today, like the Mechaber, that they make the Parsha like the Rambam. However, there is a Taz, and the Taz says he has an Eitza. What's his Eitza? He says that if you leave a little bit of space at the end of Shema, and a little bit of space at the beginning of Bahayim Shemaya, you can combine, this is what's known as tziruf, you can combine these two spaces, and it'll be considered as though you have a space in the middle of a line. Okay, so according to the Taz, you do have a way to make a parsha stuma that's good according to the Rambam and according to the Rush, and this is the minig of the vast majority of Ashkenazim, is that we do like the Taz, and our parshias are like the Taz. So that's how one makes the parashias in tefillin. If he's an Ashkenazi, like we're saying, 90-95% of Ashkenazim make like the Taz, meaning that there's a little bit of space here and a little bit of space here, and that makes it like this. And the vast majority of Sfaradim, they, like we said, have Shema going more or less till the end, and Bahayim Shemaya starting in the middle of the line, and that's what's done in tefillin. Yeah?
Is it only the Shayat?
No. Well, that's the Machlekas as well. Machlekas whether this applies to the Shel Reish or not. The Sfaradim are Machmir that it applies to the Shel Reish as well. The Magen Avraham and the Ashkenazim are Mekel that the Shel Reish, since it's on four separate pieces of cloth, so the whole Indian of Parshias doesn't really apply.
Oh, that sounds like that even though it's four separate cloth, we still have.
Yeah, yeah. Sfaradim hold that it's Ma'akiv even on the Shel Reish. Ashkenazim not, but even Ashkenazim do on the Shel Reish, like we do on the Shel Yad. Just if somebody would mess up, according to Ashkenazim, it would not be Ma'akev. According to Sfaradim, it would. Now, when you're writing a mezuzah, everything is in one column. So if you're an Ashkenazi, you're going to make your mezuzah like the Taz. Meaning, again, you're going to leave a little bit of space at the end, a little bit of space at the beginning, and according to the Taz, that's as though you have a stuma l'kule alma. Okay, so that's the minig by mezuzah, according to most Ashkenazim. The Sfaradim will have Shema going till the end of the line, and Bahayim Shemaya starting in the middle of the line, and that's going to be a stuma like the Rambam, and they're not worried about the Rush. Right? Just like by tefillin. Now, where it gets interesting is that by mezuzah, it's clear in the Gemara that even though a mezuzah is also supposed to be a parsha stuma, like by tefillin, however, if somebody made a stuma, if someone made a psucha by mezuzah, it would not be ma'akiv. So by tefillin, if somebody has a psucha, it would be ma'akiv. Okay? But by mezuzah, if somebody has a psucha, it would not be ma'akiv. Therefore, there are those, even amongst standard Ashkenazim, who say that by mezuzah, therefore, it's better to just do like the Rambam. Because since the Taz's Eitzah of Tziruf is somewhat controversial, even though the vast majority of Achrayinim accept the Taz l'halacha l'maisa, but it's not mamish totally accepted. So therefore, by mezuzah, where if one makes a parasha psucha anyway, it would be okay. So they say, just forget the Taz and just do like the Rambam, and that way manavshach. According to how we paskin, which is like the Rambam, you have a good stuma. And even according to the Rush, that it's a psucha, no, it's nishkeferlech, because the Gemara says lehedya that by a mezuzah, a psucha would be okay. So there are those that do that. But again, I think most Ashkenazim, even by mezuzah, make the sheer parasha like the Taz. Okay? Yeah. That's, okay, so we'll stop with that. If anybody has any questions, I'm here.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
That's